From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to a special edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, your host for this important discussion on the challenges facing governments and organizations in combating the complex system of human trafficking and forced labor. The recently released 2022 Trafficking in Persons Report by the U.S. State Department reveals that while progress is being made to combat human trafficking and forced labor, there is still much work to be done to improve global efforts. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, quote, "The scale of this problem is vast. There are nearly 25 million people currently victims of trafficking," unquote. Corruption allows traffickers to continue to act with impunity. In some countries, governments subject their own citizens to trafficking, including retaliation for political expression or through forced labor on projects of national interest. This can include subjecting people, including children, to forced labor in key sectors such as mining, logging, manufacturing, farming, or sending members of ethnic minority groups to be de-radicalized in camps. Another challenge fueling trafficking and forced labor is climate change. Climate is a key driver of mass migration, which is an ideal situation for traffickers. The demand for cleaner energy has created unintended consequences. Secretary Blinken pointed out, for example, in the DRC, it has much of the world's cobalt, which is a critical component for lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. Some of that cobalt is mined by children, who are then pushed into work through coercion, fraud, and force. The recently released World Migration Report from the International Organization for Migration says organized crime groups traffic in migrants in virtually every country today. Joining me to discuss the trends and challenges of human trafficking and forced labor is Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, a coalition of U.S. organizations that combat forced labor and sex trafficking in more than 100 countries. Mr. Fitzpatrick has been involved with the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking in various capacities for more than a decade and served as co-chair for the past 3 years. A broadcast journalist by training, his award-winning coverage of human rights, criminal justice, and environmental issues has aired on National Public Radio, PBS, the History Channel, and Discovery Channel. Welcome, Mr. Fitzpatrick.
Thanks for having me on, and Voice of America, too. I've covered stories from Africa for VOA.
Also joining me in this discussion is my colleague, VOA international broadcaster Carol Van Dam. Carol spoke with Mr. Fitzpatrick on the State Department's 2022 Trafficking in Persons Report earlier. Welcome, Carol.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, Mr. Fitzpatrick, let's start with just defining human trafficking and forced labor, and if you would, the scope of it.
Sure. And thanks for having me on. I hope that in our conversation, I can help provide some reasons for optimism, too, amid all those grim statistics and points that you just raised, which are all certainly valid. But there is a lot that is going on around the world to combat human trafficking. And there is a lot of success that has been accomplished as well. So right now, according to the International Labor Organization, part of the United Nations, there are about 25 million people who are in forced labor. They also go a little further and talk about forced marriage, with 15 more million individuals in marriage against their will. And that puts the number at around 40 million. Now, of the 25 million in forced labor, about 4 million of those are in forced commercial sex work. And 21 million are, as you've said, working on farms or in factories or on fishing boats or working as domestic workers or home healthcare workers or in agriculture, construction. So the vast majority of the problem is actually people working in jobs that create products consumers buy every day, so that we are actually connected to the problem, not just because this is a human rights challenge that needs to be addressed, but because consumers finance this problem and traffickers profit to the tune of about $150 billion a year in ill-gotten gains from human trafficking. So it's a global problem. It exists almost everywhere in the world. I think every country has some instance of trafficking happening in it, according to the State Department and other researchers, but it's also illegal everywhere. That's one of the good signs, is that it's not something that's happening without any kind of recourse legally. We just need to do that job and get it done.
I'm glad Terry pointed out that there's some good news in the report, but the fact is that these traffickers have gotten smarter in these past few years with the help of technology. Terry, have authorities gotten smarter too, right along with them?
Not necessarily as quickly as they could, or as robustly as they might. And a lot of that is funding. We know what works, actually, and there are new frontiers that are actually being launched in commerce and international trade and in litigation against traffickers and people who profit by associating with traffickers. So the tools are there, but the funding isn't, to engage as robustly as we might need, as the problem needs addressing. I think two words that Secretary Antony Blinken used during the introduction of the trafficking report this year helped tell the tale, which I think he called it a mixed picture of success. The report is filled with these success stories and ideas that are working, and each country's narrative in this report has suggestions on what that country can do to do better. Only 30 of the 180 plus countries that they reviewed actually meet what are known as the minimum standards or conditions to effectively combat human trafficking. Only 30. Most countries, around 100 or so, are in what's called a tier two. Tier one are the countries that are doing the best job. Those are the G7 countries, except for Italy and Japan, and some of the nations that you might think of that do have resources to do it. But most countries are in this group tier two of 100, which are trying to do a good job, but fall short of the mark. And then there's actually something called a tier three list, and there are about 20 countries there. And you might find Afghanistan, Cambodia, China, Russia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Syria. And according to the researchers in this report, they're not even trying to meet what would be considered the 3P model to actually effectively combat trafficking. And that is helping to prevent the problem, helping to prosecute the perpetrators.
Why aren't they trying harder?
Well, in some cases, those are countries that conflict prevents them from doing it. Conflict is a major driver of migration and internal displacement. And in some cases, conflict fuels armed groups that run mining sites and profit from forcing people to work for them. Trafficking is actually used as a tool of oppression and suppression and repression in conflict areas. I think of ISIS having used sex trafficking and forced marriage as a tool to recruit fighters and reward them for battlefield success. And in other cases, there are countries like China, which is actually sending Uyghur Muslims to vast forced labor camps. And this is actually another interesting and unfortunate element of trying to retool the world's economy towards solar. A lot of the minerals that are needed in batteries, not just from the DRC, but in solar panels, comes from this Uyghur autonomous region in China. In some cases, the governments are perpetrators, and in some cases, there's conflict that's driving the situation. So it's a different tale in different places.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, the International Organization for Migration's World Migration Report reveals, among many things, the stark reality that this organized crime of human trafficking and forced labor is occurring in virtually every country around the globe. Given this huge challenge facing organizations such as yours, where do you start? How do you collect data?
Well, that's a really good question, because there is not much what we know in sociological world as uniform indicators, so that you could say how many people globally are benefiting from anti-trafficking programs around the world, because different projects measure the impact of their work in different ways. And so number of lives impacted, number of victims identified, number of individuals successfully escaping or being extricated or helping escape a trafficking situation, number of people who are repatriated. Some of those statistics are very hard to come by on a global level. And this is something that needs to improve for the anti-trafficking movement and for the governments that work together to try to combat human trafficking and fund the programs that do it. About 23% of the people who are in human trafficking situations today, it's estimated, are outside their country of origin. And so migration is a significant element in what happens to people to fall into trafficking situations. And it starts usually with a very simple phrase. Want a job? Need a job? Has something happened in your life, in your family? Has there been a climate shock, drought, or flood? Has there been an earthquake? Has there been some kind of economic calamity that's affected your family or your community or your country? And this is true all over the world. Also, population has grown faster in many places than the economy has. And so people migrate to look for work, to not only change the trajectory of their lives, but to send remittances back home. And traffickers pose as legitimate labor recruiters. And once they get you away from your home, your family, your cell phone, your documents, your legal system, then the hammer drops and you find out, ah, man, I'm stuck now with thousands of dollars in debt that I could never pay off. And they're taking my documents. I can't leave. If I report to the police, I'll be arrested as somehow undocumented. And people get stuck in these situations. So what's needed there is much better, one, social safety nets, so that when calamity strikes people or regions, they have some resources to help them weather those storms. And two, we need better regulation of the foreign labor recruiter market around the world. It's a Wild West, loosely regulated industry right now that allows traffickers to get away with this for the most part. And that needs to stop. We need safer migration systems.
How do you do that, though? That's what I wonder. And I think it's really important that you point out it's not just underage girls, you know, and the sex trafficking, which is a big part of it, but the Uyghurs, the mining, the logging, like Kim pointed out in her open. How do you break that cycle when they take everything away from them, like their passports and their legal identity with documents, and they're separated oftentimes from their families, and these traffickers are so in because there's a big profit margin? I wonder how authorities are actually breaking it, and what's their percentage of people that they actually can help?
Well, it's a small percentage of people overall who receive assistance every year. But I think first, you try to prevent the problem. I think there's a misperception that poverty causes human trafficking. It's true that most people who find themselves in trafficking situations are poor, but not all poor people are trafficked. So it's a combination of poverty and other factors at community levels that drive people to have to migrate or that leave them vulnerable when an obstetrical emergency or a road accident or a house fire or something goes wrong and they have to borrow money or have to migrate for work. Thinking about healthcare systems and access to legitimate lines of credit and banking systems, or setting up community savings and loans, helping people have access to the land and community gardens so that they aren't itinerant serfs, as you find in some parts of the world that don't have their own land and have to work for others just to raise food to stay alive. I mean, there's lots of interventions you can do at a community level in very vulnerable communities that help prevent the problem and not just rely on enforcement of the law once someone has fallen into the system. Secondly, I think there's a new avenue, which is litigation and also regulation. Corporations need to be held accountable for any human trafficking or forced labor in their product supply chains. And some forward-looking companies are actually starting to do that. Walmart and McDonald's, for example, have signed up to buy tomatoes from the state of Florida that only come from the Fair Food Program, where farms are certified to be free of forced labor and labor exploitation. Patagonia, the clothing company, has decided that they want to close their supply chains. They want to know where their cotton comes from and where it's farmed and make sure that there's no forced labor in their supply chains. United Parcel Service, UPS, has trained all of their delivery people to be on the lookout. They deliver everywhere. And does something look squirrely in a place where you have just delivered? Well, report that. Same thing for Delta Airlines, training their flight crews and desk agents to look out for some telltale signs. So some corporations are actually taking the initiative, but there are elements in the United States, legal rules in the United States that are being developed and in the EU that are being developed that will prohibit the importation into their countries of something that is tainted by forced labor. That is one of the most promising new frontiers, is to cleanse the entire economy of this problem and not just look at it as an individual case-by-case problem to combat, but think of it as a systemic human rights abuse, an unfair trade practice, something that needs large-scale systemic addressing. And that's how we will really make a dent.
Yes, that sounds like a very good way to tackle this problem. You mentioned litigation. Who would initiate the litigation?
Well, there's two kinds of litigation. And one is there's not enough prosecution of human traffickers. The TIP report, Trafficking in Persons report each year from the State Department keeps track of that. And there's been some hopeful signs that it's gone up. For many years, that number was actually going down, including last year. But there has been a little bit of progress there. But the kind of litigation that I'm talking about here is trafficking victims themselves are suing for damages. In some cases, they actually have a legal right of action to be able to file their own case against the traffickers themselves, and even say, in the case of sex trafficking, against the hotels that allowed their facilities to be used for illegal sex work, and recovering damages and restitution that way. There are also class actions that are being tried by nonprofit organizations and lawyers representing children who've been trafficked into cocoa slavery in farms in West Africa. So there's a lot of litigation that's going on that tries to hold those accountable. But the real progress will be made when something known as mandatory human rights due diligence regulations really take effect. France has done them. The EU is going that way. The United States, there are proposals that are circulating right now in the Senate to do that. California has enacted transparency rules. So if corporations are required to look into their supply chains and do something about it if they find trafficking, and then give a private right of action to workers, to worker associations or unions, or to nonprofit civil society organizations to sue on as class actions on workers' behalf. That kind of litigation will get the attention of corporations, and they'll clean supply chains up pretty quickly.
Hopefully those kind of efforts get ramped up in the next few years. The report also says that climate-associated crises caused by extreme weather conditions and environmental degradation have made a survivor-informed and trauma-informed approach more important than ever. Can you talk about that a little bit?
This goes to that migration-related part of the problem that I was talking about. But, you know, it isn't also just people that decide I have to leave the country in order to support my family by sending home remittances. Most people, like 80% or so, are actually trafficked in their home community or living in their home village. And this is forced labor debt bondage, where someone has to borrow money in an emergency, and climate emergencies from droughts and severity of storms and typhoons and flooding and the degradation of the land. These are causing these kind of systemic problems where people have to borrow from anyone who will lend the money and then work it off in what ends up being conditions of slavery. And so climate is fueling this crisis. It's not creating the crisis itself, but it's exacerbating that trend that has existed for quite a long time.
Well, it's time now for a quick break, and we will return to this very important discussion. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. I'm Kim Lewis, along with my colleague, VOA international broadcaster Carol Van Dam. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voaafrica.com. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Now back to our discussion on combating human trafficking and forced labor with our guest, Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. Well, Mr. Fitzpatrick, the World Migration Report also brought out another challenge, and that is differentiating between the trafficking of people and the smuggling of migrants, with the two concepts, they say, often being confused by the media and other stakeholders. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. It's easy to miss this point, but it's vital to understand the difference. Smuggling is a crime against a country. It's taking people over a border illegally. so that they can either work legally, they'll be illegal because they're undocumented, but they won't necessarily be enforced labor once they arrive, say inside the United States in the southern states or in Texas or in Europe or elsewhere. Whereas trafficking is a crime against the individual. They may cross international borders or they may not, but it's actually transporting, harboring, receiving, or moving someone or profiting from their work through force, fraud, or coercion. So when it comes to people being moved, and trafficking legally does not require movement. It's a bit of a misperception there. The word doesn't necessarily mean you have to move a person, and they could be trafficked right in their own home. Smuggling is bringing people across international borders, and it's a crime against that country's immigration laws, whereas trafficking is something wholly different. And when it comes to the international context, it's crossing those same borders with the intent of exploiting them yourself or by someone you sell them to once they get to the other side of the river or the fence or the mountain range into the other country's territory.
How is the war in Ukraine fueling this human trafficking and forced labor?
You know, I should point out that not everyone in Ukraine is a saint. And there was a case just a few years back in Philadelphia inside the United States where there were Ukrainians who were trafficking fellow Ukrainians into the United States to work on janitorial crews at night in large department stores like Target. So Ukraine has its own trafficking problems and did before the war. But when you have a mass migration of millions of people to countries that are also struggling with trying to cope with trafficking in their countries. Romania was on what was known as a tier two watch list until just recently, saying that they were having problems. Moldova is definitely having problems, and corruption is one of the challenges there. So when you move that many people that fast, it is just a field day for traffickers to say, need a job? Come move to the UK or come move to France or come move to Italy. I'll get you there. There's work for you here. And it turns out not to be the deal that's promised. The same thing was true from Syrians, and the world did not respond the same way, unfortunately. And the same thing's true in Africa with people coming into Kenya from conflict-plagued countries on their borders. Refugee and IDP camps and refugee flows caused by conflict are just a field day for human traffickers to exploit people by just taking advantage of them. One of the good signs is that the U.S. Agency for International Development and others were helping to distribute information about human trafficking and what to watch out for and what are the tricks of the trade of human traffickers. And we're doing that from the very early days of the war in Ukraine and helping to educate people about what sounds too good to be true often is. So this idea of integrating anti-trafficking work into humanitarian assistance and to international development is another one of these key frontiers, is reasons for hope. Think about, you get a grant from the International Development Fund from the United States or the UK or Sweden or Australia to build a school in a village in a developing country. First thing you do is a little census. How many school-age children are there in this community? How much school do we need? Say it's 100. 5 months later, the school is built, the desks are there, the teachers are hired and trained, the textbooks are there, and it's a very festive day for the community because the school is built and now the children are going to have a better formal education, and 15 desks are empty because those kids are in the mine or on fishing boats or in cocoa plantations or rug factories or brick kilns or some other forced labor situation. So if you had actually integrated a reduction of child trafficking program into your school building program, you would have reached all the kids in the community instead of leaving some of those kids behind.
You know, Terry, you mentioned some of these scenarios where it's just everyday people coming into contact with possible traffickers or people who are being trafficked, like the teachers in the classroom who notice that some kids are missing. Is there some sort of international tip line for teachers or hotel guests or others who think they see something that just seems a little off?
I don't know if there's one international line, but I know that, for example, there are hotels that take a code. Their ECPAT International has a code for training people what to look out for and what to do about it. In legislation that's pending in the U.S. Congress, hotels that want to have government workers stay with them and be on the approved list for government travel will have to educate all their workers about how to understand and report both labor and sex trafficking happening on their properties. There is a number inside the United States, if you're hearing this in the U.S., which is 888-3737-888, which is the National Human Trafficking Hotline. They speak many languages and are open all the time. And if you're in a trafficking situation and need help, or if you think you've seen something that's trafficking and might want to refer them, it's best not to intervene yourself. You can make things much worse, actually, by trying to intervene in an amateurish way. Call the tip line and they can take it from there. Also, one of the other organizations that's in my alliance, Heal Trafficking, has been training medical professionals what to see and recognize. You know, many doctors in emergency rooms are trained to look for signs of domestic violence or child abuse and what to do about it if they see it. Well, Heal Trafficking has been also training doctors on what to look for human trafficking and how to recognize whether someone in your ER, in your emergency room or emergency department might be a victim and what to do for them if you find out. So there's lots of initiatives that are happening within individual sectors economically to confront the problem.
And in looking at the long-term mental and physical health, are there programs geared towards helping with the actual mental health of someone?
There's quite a large body of literature and experience about what works and what doesn't, and how those who are trafficking survivors can be employed and engaged in helping other survivors cope with that journey from through recovery towards self-reliance and resilience. There are alliances of just survivors. The Survivor Alliance, also the National Survivors Network, are helping to train up survivors who can do this work and help be frontline social workers and case workers in shelters and in counseling. And one thing needs to be said here is that we need to have a survivor or victim-centered approach to the problem, particularly when it comes to law enforcement, particularly in sex work. A lot of individuals are actually arrested under prostitution laws when they're actually being forced to commit those crimes by pimps and traffickers.
Some experts complain that survivors are not respected. One of them was Don Schiller, a training director with the LA County Project Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Human Trafficking. She said, for those who began to identify as survivors, the feeling of being oppressed was in essence replicated by the very organizations that they relied on for aid, even more so for those with diverse identities. She said some of those survivors who wanted to help catch the bad guys basically were overlooked as experts. Is that a big problem?
It is both in terms of the standard of care is different at different organizations that are doing the work. And right up front, in terms of individuals being arrested by law enforcement when they're actually victims and being treated as criminals instead of as victims and being put into the law enforcement channel instead of into the survivor and victim assistance channel. The United States in particular needs what is called a victim protocol, which it doesn't have. It's required by Congress to create, but has not yet been created. And so that's one of the areas that needs to improve, where you have standards of care and training for law enforcement as to what to look for to identify individuals and to make sure you don't ask them questions as a law enforcement officer that could be used against their case. Imagine how hard it must have seemed and impossible it must have seemed 150 years ago when small groups of individuals were trying to outlaw the international slave trade. But they succeeded. And back then, it was baked into the world economy. It was considered economically necessary for the economy of the world to have slavery. And it was considered morally acceptable. But activists won. And many of us who are doing this work today feel we're following in their footsteps to actually give that promise of freedom to everyone who deserves it, which is everyone on the planet, because slavery was never really ended. It was outlawed, but not ended, and it's taken new forms around the world today. And even though there are tens of millions of people trapped in this situation, and it might seem impossible, we're equally hopeful that we will succeed in ending this problem, just as the earlier activists were successful in outlawing it.
Thank you so much. What an excellent way to end the show. This was a very enlightening discussion, and I thank you for taking the time to discuss the challenges and progress being made in combating the illegal practice of human trafficking and forced labor. Our guest is Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. Also joining me for this discussion was VOA international broadcaster Carol Van Dam. Carol, thank you for taking the time to join us.
It was my pleasure to be here.
I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join Carol Castiel next weekend for Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.